One of the things that I'd like to ask everybody to think about is the Endangered Species Act an endangered act at this point?
It doesn't seem like it's going away anytime soon, and what we're looking at. But what I would like to say about it is it really did transform the direction that reclamation has headed over in the last couple of decades, and it's gone at a pace that, you know, kind of slowly moved towards trying to manage for a single species to try to work that out. But folks quickly understood that it's really the degraded system that the species live in that needs the full attention, and that's where we're arriving at in. How we're working within the context of the Middle Rio Grande ESA collaborative program. We need to elevate that to a higher level now to really live within the means that we have hydrologically, and then also to improve that habitat to allow for all the species that live in the river to survive.
Actually, the Rio Grande watershed's in better shape, isn't it, than the Colorado River watershed?
It depends on which part. I mean, if you go below Caballo Reservoir, it's a plumbing system, and they turn it off in the fall when there's no river, and they turn it back on in the spring when there's enough water to irrigate. Uh-huh. So
there's a Morales Dam down there.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Actually, I've seen the river with no water down there last year, and it's pretty startling. One of the things I'd like to ask folks to think about, a friend of mine once said somebody should write a book about the relationship between water and electricity in the American Southwest. And one of the thoughts that's come to mind, and you brought this up, John, Lake Mead's a foot and a half away from the lowest, and if it gets too much lower, it's not inconceivable that it wouldn't be able to turn the hydroelectric generators. Mm-hmm. And the same holds for the Glen Canyon Dam. If those lakes get too low, they simply can't turn the turbines that generate the electricity, and we have an enormous reliance on the electricity. One of the things that Sonia alluded to was the notion of the cash register dams, and those are the dams like the bridge in Marble Canyon that didn't get constructed. But the notion was is they could make electricity that could be sold. Now, what my big worry is, I mean, this is one of the myriad nightmares that we think about in this business, is what happens if they can't get the electricity from both Glen and Hoover dams. Because we do have enormous coal deposits in the American Southwest, and even though Obama and the Environmental Protection Agency has sort of put the no-no on construction of more coal-fired power plants, could that possibly be, does anybody have a sense of how that might be overturned in case the hydroelectric power might be threatened? Mm-hmm. See, this is one of the things that I think is that we have to imagine these possible scenarios because here we are. I mean, we're us folks here in the Rio Grande watershed, and there are those folks over in the Colorado River watershed, and now because of interbasin transfers of water, we're all one big interrelated gang of folks, and John really pointed that out very well. And what we need to do, I think, is begin to really become much more involved within our home watersheds, because we have probably, like you would have, a clearer picture than, say, somebody in Washington would, Mike, with regard to what's happening here. And so I think we should vigorously try to get all of us involved in any of this. I had a list of issues. Well, what sort of compromises? This is, John just had an article in yesterday's, was it? Yeah, yesterday's Albuquerque Journal, which was very good, that focused on what's happening right here in the Rio Grande and all of these potentially volatile situations. And so one of the issues that I wanted to bring up for everybody to think about and address is what sort of compromises do we envision within New Mexico that are necessary to address, and I would like to bring out agriculture versus urban. Let's start there.
One of the things that, I go back to the Colorado River Basin because I think it's a model, and because I think this conversation is much farther along in Colorado River Basin mm-hmm. than it is here. One of the conversations that's going on in Colorado River Basin now is the attempt, and sometimes with some success, to set up relationships between municipalities and farm water users. So that rather than fighting over the water, there's some collaboration. So for example, the Palo Verde Irrigation District, some of the oldest rights on the lower Colorado River around Blythe, the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California pays a bunch of farmers a flat fee every year for the right to get their water in a dry year. So the farmer gets money every year. And when it's particularly dry, then the Metropolitan Water District says, okay, we're going to need water this year, and the farmer fallows her field for a year and gets essentially an amount of money equivalent to what they would have made farming to leave the land idle. And the money goes, the water goes to Southern California. The next year, when there's enough water, the land goes back into production. So we're not taking land out of production. This is only one example. There's lots of different kinds of arrangements like this. There's a lot of creativity going on to try to come up with these collaborative sharing agreements, and they're tricky to pull off because you have to respect the economy, the place from which the water is coming. You have to do it in a way that third-party effects on, you know, the tractor dealer are managed. So it's not easy to do, and it can be done badly. But there are things like that that are contemplated as a new piece of legislation, the New Mexico, what's it called, Drought...
Drought Relief Act.
Drought Relief Act that Senator Udall introduced a couple of weeks ago that contemplates setting up some structures to experiment with those sorts of things here, to try mm-hmm. to figure out how to do it. It's not something you just wave a magic wand and happen. It takes a lot of collaboration and cooperation, and you know, Mike talks about trust building. But there's room to do these things if, instead of fighting about water, we recognize that we're all in this together and figure out how we can come up with mutually beneficial arrangements.
That's great. I know that... Oh, thanks, Jacobo. Wow. There are all of these issues. wish we had about 4 hours to do this instead of an hour and a half. Here in the Rio Grande watershed, in your article, I think it came out to four times as much water used by agriculture as by the cities. Is there any sense of what crops are grown? Or how does agriculture use its water? Is there any study of that?
There is a knowledge of the cropping patterns, the historic cropping patterns that have gone on. It's a kind of an alfalfa, hay dominated type of agriculture in the Middle Valley. But there's a lot of, as you go a little farther south, there's a lot of farmers that grow the vegetable crops and the chili and the corn and some other crops. And I don't remember the exact ratios, but I would say that somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 60% is probably in the hay and alfalfa cropping pattern for the Middle Valley.
And where does that hay go? Does it get used here or does it go elsewhere?
Well, it depends. There's a certain amount that's consumed in the area. There's folks that have learned how to, grow high dollar hay for racehorses and things that are outside of the basin, and they go ahead and deliver the hay in that direction. I know if you drive US 285 at all, you'll see large hay trucks coming from the San Luis Valley. One after another for year-round delivering hay down to the Roswell area for dairy farms down in that neck of the woods. So you're using Colorado upper basin water to grow hay for dairy farms down in the Roswell basin. That's a water short basin. So it's kind of an interesting concept that within the same area.
But it is a reciprocal thing here. I'd read somewhere so where a lot of the hay may go to China. Is that?
There's not much New Mexico hay going to China. That's it's a the economics of hay have shipping distance issues. So there's sort of these overlapping economic spheres. So the hay in New Mexico kind of stays within a several hundred mile. It becomes uneconomical to ship beyond too many hundreds of miles. The Imperial Valley in Southern California and alfalfa in Central California is going back. These big shipping containers come to China with, you know, cheap plastic goods for Walmart, and then the shipping containers go back empty, and so it's really cheap to just put hay in them and send them back. So the economics are, that's really driving a lot of alfalfa economics in California, but less so here. But it's a national market, so it spills over economically here.
That's fascinating. Hay going back. One of the things that I am concerned about is the coal that is mined in the American West. A lot of it is going to China at this point. And we may, in our own country, have created all of a sudden some pretty hefty regulations with regard to coal-fired power plants, but if coal was burned in China, it's going to affect our atmosphere here. And that's something we have to think about. I guess one of the thoughts, one of the biggest thoughts I have with regard to this whole subject is we look at water as a resource that's not as prevalent as it used to be. I know that when the Colorado River Compact was put together back in 1922, according to Norris Hundley, who did this wonderful book called A Great Thirst, it was thought that 17 million acre feet a year came down the Colorado River, and it's closer, I think, to 14 on the average, but we're having drier years. And so is there a sense, like in the work that you've been doing, John, is there a sense that people understand that growth, just endless growth, has to be gradually curtailed in order to be, so that we can accommodate a human population with diminishing resources?
I think it's a more complicated discussion than that. If you look at the conversation across the West, there are people who would argue that. There are people who would argue that because of water scarcity, we need to curtail immigration from other countries. There are people who argue there's plenty of water for the humans that we have here and lots more of them if we would just stop growing alfalfa. I mean, it's Colorado River Basin, 80% of the water is growing alfalfa and pasture, and we could double our population by just restricting alfalfa. And there's a lot of different ways you can get the math to pan out and figure out how to live with less water by doing less of any one of a number of things. The interesting thing is how do we collaboratively across these various communities with various different interests and various different values, how do we figure out which one of these solutions or how to decide among these different solutions? I mean, we could easily decide, we don't think Phoenix should be there anymore. That would work. That's one way of making the water math balance. We could decide that Albuquerque shouldn't be here. It's another way to make the water math balance. There's a lot of different ways you can make the water math balance. The trick is, how do we as a society have the right kind of conversation to figure out how to balance all these different competing values and interests and come up with a solution that fits in the spaces in between all that?
Well, that's precisely the point, really, because does it make sense that we vigorously invoke the local levels and have people look at it from all the various perspectives that we can possibly muster? In other words, so that it's not just economics driving it or just not development driving it or agriculture driving it, but all the ecosystem itself has been left out of the equation until just now, relatively speaking, over the last while. And I remember when I was doing that radio series on the Colorado River 13 years ago now, one of the water lawyers was very nervous about pitting the Endangered Species Act against another piece of legislation with regard to who gets what water. And so these are some of the questions that I think we really, what I'm just trying to invigorate more and more is that we all have to get into the discussion, because everybody has their own perspective and everybody has their own expertise. And that's basically what the humanities are all about, you know, is bringing in as many of the different perspectives as we possibly can. That's why what Elaine Hebert is putting on this Saturday over in Dane Hall at UNM.
Dane
Smith.
Room 120, right?
Yes.
Breakfast at 8:30, right?
Yeah. Coffee time. Anyway. Well, here's a question for Sonia. What effect will the closing of coal-fired stacks in the Four Corners area have on water and some of the native political issues you spoke of?
Well, if we close the coal-fired plants, we can stop the coal mining, and we can stop the environmental and cultural destruction that is happening in the wake of that coal mining. I also think that it would free, if we stop the generating stations, if we shut them down, it also frees up water that can be used in other ways that now are going to, you know, those 23 million gallons of water that the Navajo generating station chews up per minute, it automatically frees that up that could be used, you know, for the rest of us, you know. And so I think those would be the, you know, the biggest benefits in my mind. You know?
One of the things that comes to mind, and I've seen this happen over the last two generations, is the focus among the Navajos has been ever more economically oriented.
Right.
And that's not just true for the Navajos. That's for just about everybody we know. Mm-hmm. And it's as though economics has driven absolutely everything. And it seems to me that we have pitted economics against ecologically sound thinking in a way that's not healthy. And so the optimism that was generated here so far this evening, if we can start to understand that economics itself is but one factor in this huge, bigger picture, that would be really good to note, I think. Okay, let's... The hard part for my aging eyes is, although I must say that the handwriting is not as bad as it was last week. This is for Mike. Are there any plans for mandatory water conservation measures, household, agriculture, and industrial? Currently, it seems to be only voluntary.
That's a question near and dear to my heart because I was with the city of Santa Fe as the original water director when the city bought the utility from PNM. And that transition from a privately held, profit-oriented water utility to a public welfare organized entity allowed us to actually deal with mandatory water conservation at the municipal level. When we were up against the wall in 97, we were able to convince the community, even the economic components of the community, the business community, that it was imperative that we implemented water conservation, mandatory water conservation rules to allow us the time to fully plan and develop the water system. And it's amazing, the city rose to the occasion, and they were running about 140 gallons per capita per day at that time and reduced it down to below 90 gallons per capita per day in a very short period of time. It was pretty incredible. And so people do understand that we have a lavish use of water in most cases, and there's plenty of room for some mandatory conservation. And I think Albuquerque's done the same thing. I actually took out my lawn here last year because I was using quite a 10,000 gallons a month in the summer just on my lawn, and that was ridiculous. So those are the kinds of things that are happening, and the rules that are implemented at that level to encourage folks to make those changes are developing rapidly, actually.
That's really great. I know that Bill DeBuise, when he made his presentation here over 4 months ago, or in February at any rate, one of his things is that he claims that you shouldn't conserve water because that just makes water available for more development. And it's one of those strange thoughts that Brother DeBuise came up with, which is, it makes sense if you're Bill DeBuise.
Well, and I would like to say, too, that at least at the federal level, I'm not sure if the question was aimed at should the feds, you know, come in with a heavy hand and require conservation. I think we encourage it. Reclamation has an extensive water conservation program where we look at the possibilities of how federal resources can encourage folks, both in the irrigation community and the municipalities, to go ahead and implement water conservation programs.
The city of Albuquerque continues to approve large development on the West Mesa. How can they do this with our scarcity of water?
Good question.
Good question.
We're all wondering.
Right.
Is it part of the juggernaut of the economic paradigm that we think we can continue to develop and we're in denial? We're in denial in Rio Grande? That's a very bad joke if you listen. Well, it's one of those unanswerable questions. In other words, maybe it would be good to talk to the city council vigorously about the whole sense of continued growth relative to the amount of water that is necessary to maintain right now relative to what it's going to have to maintain in the future. These are big questions. Development, to me, is one of the biggest issues. I know up in Santa Fe, I live up there, and thinking about development, and thinking about the waning aquifers. And I feel really pretty good from what you had to say, that the city of Santa Fe is now relying more on surface water than groundwater. Mm-hmm. That's a huge factor. And like we talked about in an earlier one of these gatherings, it used to be until 1982 that the city of Albuquerque thought that it rested over the equivalent of Lake Superior or some such. And then it was proven otherwise. The cones of depression are depressing. Anyway, another question for Sonia. Do the Navajo regret making priorities of coal-fueled energy over water rights?
I think the Central Arizona case, in that particular case, they clearly, in fact, the quote that I read from Annie Dodge Wanika, this part of the paper, but she actually says that hydropower is a thing of the past. And coal-fired power plants are the future. And, you know, so at that time period, absolutely they saw coal, you know, trumping water.
Wow. Here's one. Do isotopes leak into the Rio Grande from the Chama drinking water?
The Chama drinking water? Well, there's evidence that Los Alamos isotopes are migrating towards the Rio Grande. Los Alamos Labs has an extensive network of observation wells that show that it has migrated into the deeper aquifer that is connected to the Rio Grande. And so the City of Santa Fe designed their diversion and treatment system to deal with the isotopes that do come in the Los Alamos.
Well, then here's another one. A comment on the fuel spill at Kirtland Air Force Base and effects on aquifers.
So the Kirtland fuel spill, for those who aren't familiar with the Kirtland Air Force Base, discovered in 1999 or possibly earlier that an underground fuel line for fueling aircraft had been leaking for decades, probably since the 1950s. Really massive contamination, certainly the largest contamination in the metro area, one of the largest in groundwater contamination in the state of New Mexico. It's moving, creeping slowly northward toward Albuquerque, Bernalillo County Water Utility Authority's Ridgecrest Wellfield. And I think I would argue not enough is being done to clean it up or slow its spread to protect those wells. The threat is not an immediate public health threat. You know, test the wells regularly, the wells are clean. We have a reasonable idea of where it is. What the real threat here is the loss of a huge water reserve. You know, this groundwater becomes unusable. It's essentially a water supply problem because, you know, we have the ability to detect it and shut down wells and stop using the section of the aquifer. We don't want to do that. This is incredibly valuable water. And I think that's where the real problem is there. And also the long-range possibility that, you know, we could recharge that aquifer. It's a place where we can store water. We can put water down there in years of surplus to withdraw. And this area happens to be one of the best places where one could do that, and it's probably lost to that possible use.
I know that that Pat Mulroy years ago told me about the whole notion of water banking, and Las Vegas, she was the director for the Southern Nevada Water Authority, and a really bright lady who John told me the other day has just retired, and I always thought that she'd be a really good candidate for Secretary of the Interior. She's a smart lady. But she's also come up with this notion, much to the dismay of a bunch of my rancher friends up in the Great Basin Desert, of pumping water out of the Great Basin Desert into Las Vegas. Because Las Vegas, well, Nevada got short shrifted in 1922. They only got 300,000 acre feet as an allocation annually from the Colorado River. And but one of the things that Pat mentioned to me was this whole idea of water banking. It didn't work geophysically in Nevada, but it would work if water could be pumped into areas in Arizona where the geophysical structure, subterranean, would be capable of handling the water. And so one of the things that she was working on was working out a deal with Arizona to water bank Nevada water for the shortfall. And this is another act of mutual cooperation that people just have to be thinking about. I think that the whole situation with the Great Basin Desert, that's something that was sort of popped on those folks up in the Great Basin Desert, and they didn't realize this was coming down the pike, that their aquifer, which is a closed basin, the Great Basin Desert is a closed basin. It's part of Nevada, northern Nevada, and Utah, and it's an incredible place. It's a high desert, about 5,000 feet. Sagebrush characterizes the vegetation, and it's a wonderful place. If the aquifer is pumped out for urban growth, this is the thing that we worry about. We have to factor the ecosystem back into the bigger picture. I had really wanted a nice way to end this series of things that we're doing. So I invited two wonderful friends of mine to come and perform a song. The song is called La Indita del Rio Grande, which to me is one of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard in my life. So, without further ado, I would like to introduce my two great friends, Chuy Martinez and Oti Ruiz.
Pájaros, truenos y rayos, alas de papel. Sangre de Cristo enseña su corazón.
Anajeo.